Edward Angel Fire in New Mexico, and Stanton T. Friedman's with us, and everybody knows you, Stan. You've been around for a long time, and now...
That's a penalty for being old.
Well,
and bold, and loud.
I can understand that, being the same.
I don't know which of us is older, to tell you the truth.
You just slightly.
Oh, okay.
Just slightly. You would tell me, first of all, before we do anything, tell me a little bit about this Magic Man movie thing that the Bruce Zabel was talking to me about.
Bryce Zabel, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I've known Bryce for about 15 years, and actually he wrote a favorable review on the back cover of the book Top Secret Magic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the Majestic 12 documents.
Right.
And especially in the second edition, I make a point of trying to deal with all the objections to these documents that have been put forth by the noisy negativists of one kind or another. And I think I have satisfactorily provided a rebuttal for all of these objections. And yet there are still people in ufology who say, well, everybody knows those documents are fraudulent. And it's aggravating because they don't give you facts and data. I've been at this a long time. I've been to 20 archives. Anyway, Bryce has been well aware. You know, he did the series Dark Skies,
mm-hmm.
which really is a similar sort of thing to the Majestic 12 business. So he also knows Don Schmidt and how Don has had his ups and downs in Roswell investigation, and that Don's and my paths have crossed from time to time. Don didn't really start into Roswell until he asked me a question at a lecture I gave in Illinois at a college. He said, is there really anything more to be done with Roswell? This is 20 years ago. And I said, Don, there's plenty to do, but I can't afford to do it. I've been spending tons of money on trying to locate people and all the rest. I live back very far east. yeah, there's a lot to be done. There are more witnesses to be found, more documents to be found. So he pursued his path of investigating, which he's done a lot of. He's changed partners, so have I, in a sense. And Bryce saw the possibilities here of something, put it succinctly, would be sort of like all the president's men and JFK combined.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there's dramatic impact here. There's conflict. There's how things have progressed, positive and negative. We both had problems with some witnesses who turned out to be fraudulent. You know, and how do you handle this? We think, considering that we've been at this, you know, it's more than 20 years, I've been investigating Roswell for 32 years, that it might bring the story home to the public in a way that only movies can. You know, I've got my name on 5 books now, and Don has written several books. But in today's world, a movie can have far more impact mm-hmm. than a book. I mean, I hate to admit that. So I'm hoping that they're working on a screenplay now. And, you know, the funny question is, so who's going to play you, Stan? And I don't know who's going to play me in the movie. In other words, this will be a feature film.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a documentary.
Right.
It's a movie that has a story to tell.
You mentioned All the President's Men. It's something similar to that,
yeah.
that movie.
Yeah, the efforts that those guys went through, Woodward and Bernstein. And,
right.
you know, I've been saying for years, people say, what would it take to break this story loose? I've said it would take a Woodward and Bernstein with some backing from somebody like the Washington Post. It wasn't just those two guys, after all. There was a lot of money spent, you know, following the money, doing all those other things that need to be done. And I think you could do it in 6 months if you really made the effort. So I'm excited at the prospect, partly because I respect Bryce and Don Most, they're both very interested in the subject. People remember Don Most from Happy Days, but he's also been involved in other motion pictures
yes,
and production
has.
And so forth. So, and Bryce is a wheel in the industry in Hollywood, if you will, president of one of the important groups and stuff.
Yeah, despite me mispronouncing his first name, I do know him and met him recently. And he's quite a go-getter.
He is a go-getter. And so I'm excited about... I've had other dealings with Hollywood. Every so often somebody, oh, we want to make a show, you want to be involved. Yeah, I'm interested. And they never seem to work out. And, even my own documentary, UFOs Are Real, which was done way back in, 79. It's hard to imagine. My dealings with Hollywood were not the kind that I really appreciated, because I'm concerned with facts, with data, with truth. That's what a scientist is all about. And these guys, that didn't seem to be their major concern.
Yeah.
But Bryce,
That's an understatement.
Yeah, I'm being kind. Be kind to dumb Hollywoodians. I just made up a new word. So I'm really hopeful that this will turn into something good and big. And, you know, I must admit, in making UFOs Are Real, and I travel all over the country, I found movie making one of the most frustrating things I've ever done. Because you spend hours, days to get, you know, 3 minutes worth of film.
Mm-hmm.
And you slog along day after day, and I'm too impatient for that. I want to, if I'm going to go to an archive, I want to dig into things, you know, get hours worth of work, not 2 minutes worth of work.
Yeah, this project, even though it's now well underway, will probably be 18 months or so before it's finished.
Oh, at least, yeah. And I just hope I'm around when it's finished, that's all. And my great-grandson can see his great-grandpa portrayed in the film.
Now, you mentioned a couple of things that I wanted to follow up here a little bit about. Don Smith, you're the one that got him interested, huh?
Well, to dig into Roswell, yes.
Yes.
The fund for UFO research had been sort of off to the side. Not the fund, I'm sorry, the QFOS. Dr. Hynek's organization, and Don worked closely with Dr. Hynek. And they were very, how shall I put this, conservative about crash saucers. Center for UFO Studies, we're talking about. And, you know, I knew Alan. He was the same age as my father. He didn't like being reminded of that. But I could never get him to dig into this question of interstellar travel. For some reason, and it's part of what I'm going to say here, astronomers are stuck at the Pony Express stage of development of human transport. You know, if you were to say, what's a fast means for spreading information? If you told me Pony Express, I'd say, I'll take the Internet, you know, instantaneous kind of thing. These guys haven't gotten beyond the notion of chemical rockets, for God's sakes. And Alan had the same problem. So Don asked me only because he knew that I had been digging into it for a long time and would have some idea of what the scope of the work. I won't say I inspired him. That's probably the wrong way to put it. But I gave him a straight answer, and I said I'd help if I could, and I have. And we've shared views about witnesses and so forth. We also have spent a lot of time in Roswell. He more than I would say.
You mentioned a little earlier that both of you have been led down the primrose path occasionally. I have too. We all have.
Really? Yeah.
Why do you think these guys do this sort of thing?
You know, I don't know. Frank Kaufman was his bête noire, and the funny thing is, right from the beginning with Frank, I was suspicious because he said and did things that didn't make any sense to me. And I was pleased, at least before he died, that when I asked him... Now, Frank, remember, had this great story. He was a member of a group of nine at Roswell, and they could do anything. They knew everybody. They had everything. He knew all about Roswell. And he was over at White Sands when they spotted on radar this object that exploded on the screen, and he called back and somebody had seen something come down. He rushed back over the mountains to Roswell, woke up Colonel Blanchard and Jesse Marcel, and they drove out across the rough country and spotted this craft on the ground. And, you know, by the end of the day, the end of that morning, they had brought out a flatbed truck from Roswell and put this thing on it and brought it back to the base, and, you know, just like that. And to me, that made absolutely no sense whatsoever. In the first place, you can't, the people who owned the land said the only way you could get out in that area was with a horse. There were no roads and stuff. And secondly, Colonel Blanchard was head of the only atomic bombing group in the world. he would never have left the base without some better idea of what was going on out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it was one of his B-29s, which just happened to have a nuclear weapon on board, yeah, he'd have gone out right. But other than something like that, he never would have. Jesse Marcel, I was the first to talk to Jesse way back in 1978.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that. Nobody. Go ahead.
Well, just that he would never have reacted the way he did days later if he had already been out there, already seen bodies and wreckage and all this kind of stuff. And it's standard practice when an airplane goes down that you want to see things in situ, that is, as they are, so that you can discover, you know, was in the case of an airplane, was the landing gear cracked, were the flaps up or down? And you can't just go gathering stuff up and shove it on a truck and get it out of there. There was no danger of tourists coming along. This was out in the middle of nowhere. You know, that was not a problem. So I was pleased when Frank finally, just before he died, I was at his home with several other people and asked him, did he take Blanchard out? No. Did he take Jesse Marcel out? No. So I was sort of vindicated, but I couldn't convince Don's former associate, Kevin Randall. To him, Frank Kaufman was the answer to all the problems. He's got a whole book in which Frank's name comes up all the time, mm-hmm. is knowing everything. And to me, I understood Frank. He was from New York, which helped explain a few things.
Yeah.
I'm from New Jersey. That was part of the problem. Also, there was a whole business with Bill Moore and me and Don and Kevin Randall, conflict and human interactions, if you will. And people wanted to blame me for what Bill was doing, and Kevin turned on Don, had apparently said that he had some degrees he didn't have, and Kevin defended Don without doing any checking. What I did was the next day after I heard that, I called the post office where supposedly Don worked, and he answered the phone. He wasn't just walking by.
Mm-hmm.
So he had never told me he had those degrees, so I didn't feel, you know, that he had lied to me. Anyway, there is conflict, and there are joys, too. Frankly, when I heard about the MJ-12 documents, Bill Moore called me up and read me the list of the names of people, and he saved the best one for last, Donald Menzel, Harvard debunker of UFOs. Boy, that's all we need was somebody, you know, was that. And I didn't like Menzel. I'd had one run-in with him. At Harvard, I was speaking to a retired an engineering alumni group,
mm-hmm.
and I called him earlier in the day because I didn't know whether this was a campus-wide thing or just for this group. I often give presentations of members of a certain group, American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, that sort of thing. So I called, and Dr. Menzel, yes, my name is Stanton Friedman, and, oh, I know all about you, he says. I said, oh, you saw my congressional testimony next to yours? No, I've seen letters and memos. You can't be a scientist and believe in flying saucers. And I laughed. What else am I going to do?
Yeah.
He got mad, started ranting. And I said, look, Dr. Menzel, I didn't call to argue with you. I called out of courtesy. I'm going to be speaking on your campus and didn't know whether you knew about it. So I wanted to invite you personally to be there. Well, of course I won't go. And I told that story that night at the lecture, incidentally. And Alan Hynek told me he never could have told the story. Anyway, so here his name is on this list. And I'm thinking, boy, that's all we need. Well, I had a couple of leads that maybe moved me in the right direction. And some of the Vannevar Bush was the top dog scientist in the country, head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, which covered the atom bomb and a proximity fuse and 80 other devices for winning a war. And there was a letter in his papers from Menzel's attorney thanking Bush for his testimony on Donald's behalf at a loyalty hearing. Loyalty hearing? That raised a lot of questions. There's a big legal firm in Boston. This was not a little podunk outfit mm-hmm. that wrote the letter. And Bush didn't have to defend anybody. He was above all that sort of stuff. And then I got a grant from the Fund for UFO Research that would cover the cost of going to Harvard. I had to get permission from three different people to look at his papers. I'd already seen his UFO correspondence at the American Philosophical Society Library in Philadelphia. Nothing exciting there, except the communication between him and Ed Condon. They obviously knew each other and stuff. So I'm going there with an open mind and not really having any idea of finding anything very useful. And at the Harvard archives, after getting permission from three different people to look at this stuff, I don't see anything. So just because I'm a curious guy, there was a file labeled John F. Kennedy. That seems strange. And so I looked at that file and was totally shocked because there's correspondence between him and Kennedy. Now, the connection was straightforward. Kennedy was on the board of overseers at Harvard, and his area of interest, and every member picked an area and got to know it better, was astronomy. And so Menzel was his guide, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, and I got this from his wife, too, that Menzel, like JFK, greatly respected him, was impressed. He even wrote his own reports, and there were other guys who had asked Menzel to write the report for them, you know. But here we find a statement, Menzel to Kennedy, saying, there is an area where I may be able to be of considerable utility. That's with regard to the National Security Agency. I have had a longer continuous association with this organization, more than 30 years at that time, of anybody in the country. When we are properly cleared to each other, I can tell you more. You know, those are rather exciting words. And then when I look at his unpublished autobiography, there's Menzel saying he was very active in cryptography. He was did classified work for the FBI, for the CIA, for 30 different companies. He led a double life. Nobody on the outside knew that.
Mm-hmm.
As far as they knew, he was a debunker. And the thing that really caught me is you don't need a high-level security clearance to teach astronomy at Harvard. You know, all the other 11 out of the 12, I knew from the jobs they'd held that they had to have high-level security mm-hmm. clearances. Three were directors of Central Intelligence, you know, stuff like that. So these findings on Menzel, and then talking to his wife, talking to people who knew him at the office, I found one guy who was very close to him who knew that he did a lot of work for the government. That's all he knew. He didn't know anything about MJ-12 or anything like that. And then, so I kept digging, and as a matter of fact, somebody, a MUFON person in Minneapolis, mentioned that they had had a big 50th anniversary of the organization thing, and he got to talk to somebody there who mentioned that he knew Menzel and that Menzel had left in a hurry one time under sort of strange circumstances. So I talked to the guy. And yes, he was younger at the time than Menzel was. And Menzel suddenly had to leave. He did consulting work. As a matter of fact, I found papers in Menzel's file. He was getting like $18,000 a year as a consultant. This is back in the 40s.
And that good was money.
A very good money. I'll tell you. And so I asked this guy, and he said, yeah, he remembered Menzel, and he was a younger man than the one I was talking to. And I said, there was something about, at one point he left in a hurry. He said, yeah, one summer, he worked there summers usually, mm-hmm. you know, as many professors do. And he suddenly had to leave. And he had the impression, the guy I was talking to, that it was very classified and that Menzel did, and it was important. And Menzel wouldn't tell him what it was, just that he had to be gone. And so I asked very carefully, biting my tongue the whole time, what year was that? And there was a pause, and so, well, let me see now. Yeah, 1947, I think. I didn't say, was it 47?
Yeah, right.
Which would just provide me with an echo, which mm-hmm. would mean nothing. So anyway, to make a long story short, the joy of finding out that Menzel belonged to that team, much as I didn't like him, I developed an appreciation for him. And I had so much reaction. How can a guy lead a double life? I said, every spy leads a double life. There were three guys in England, Burgess, McLean, and whoever the third guy was, he was the most famous of them, who were spies for Russia working for MI5. Now, that's leading a double life because you've really got to be careful.
Certainly a double agent, right.
You know, and so it happens all the time. anyway, that was a high point. There were low points. You tracked down people. I found a guy, an archaeologist, who mentioned that one of the stories that I was very interested in was the crash over in the plains of San Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
And found a guy named, whose name was Drake, actually, not Frank Drake. And he mentioned that there was this guy that he knew who had come to a conference in Mexico and had worked at Los Alamos and had stopped by the plains of San Augustine. He knew something from working at Los Alamos that there had been a crash in the plains of San Augustine. And I got his name, and he lived in Ottawa, and it was an unusual enough name, so I was able to track it down, a number, called, talked to his wife, and he's off on a dig in British Columbia, and he'll be back in a month. Call back then. Okay, great. I established this guy was a professional. He was a PhD, legitimate researcher and all that. And I called back a month later, and he had just died of a heart attack.
Wow.
And, you know, what do you ask a widow? It just happened. And so a year later, I called. She remembered me because her sister had just died. So that's twice I hit. So that was great disappointment, you know. Why didn't I call 5 days sooner or stuff like that? One of the frustrations. I was able to establish that he had been at Los Alamos. And Los Alamos has an enormous amount of information. When I visited there, I had professional dealings as a nuclear physicist on the nuclear rocket program. They were working on nuclear rockets. We at Westinghouse were. And so I was able to look in their library, and they had a lot of stuff on UFOs. Obviously, there was great interest there. As a matter of fact, the first privately published version of Project Blue Book, Special Report 14, came from a scientist who had worked at Los Alamos. And that really got me rolling on UFOs. So to get back to Magic Men, as I've talked to Bryce and Don, and Don Schmidt has talked to them, we've come up with a lot of these little events that happened, these significant events that, in retrospect, have dramatic impact. And so I'm optimistic that with his skills and imagination and knowledge of the field, a lot of people who want to do a UFO movie because they think people would be interested, but don't know a damn thing.
Right.
And so that's what's different here, is that we have people who...
So you're really hopeful that this movie, if it gets made, and probably will, and you know the people involved, so it'll probably turn out pretty well, it may open some doors, get some people interested.
Yeah, because I found that people never want to be leading the pack and coming out from behind the veil of secrecy. I worked under security for 14 years. I understand that. And, you know, I get people are so ignorant about security. I've had one guy say, well, all those members of MJ-12 would have told their spouses. No, you don't tell your wife. I never told my wife anything classified.
Mm-hmm.
You can't control what your wife says to anybody.
Right.
If the enemy thinks he can get information from spouses, the heck with you. You know, pillow talk, that's the way to find out what's going on. I've had people say, the SETI people really aggravate me. Silly effort to investigate. That's
You're talking SETI. About that here, I think.
Yeah, that's one of the major points that I will make. Is here we got these guys saying the government can't keep secrets. And Seth Shostak, now I've met Seth, he's heard me talk, I've heard him talk, big shot in the SETI field. I mean, this is a government that, look how they fouled up at Katrina and FEMA and stuff. It's the same government that runs the post office, for God's sakes. Now, why didn't he say something like the NRO, the NSA, the CIA, the DIA, all the intelligence agencies? How about Lockheed developing the stealth aircraft? 10 years, $10 billion in complete secrecy. I mean, I get a little irked at people who haven't done their homework. And part of my theme today, or tomorrow actually, will be that they don't seem to realize that aside from research being conducted in academia, the publisher parish crowd, as I call them, there's an enormous amount of very good, advanced, applied research and development that goes on outside of academia. The national laboratories, Los Alamos, Sandia, Lawrence Livermore, three nuclear weapons labs, amongst them employ 20,000 people. Thousands of professionals have an annual budget over $1 billion. This isn't six professors and 12 grad students, for goodness sakes. There are things like the General Electric Research Labs, the Bell Labs, the Lewis Research Labs. There's Hanford Works. There's Oak Ridge National Laboratory. There's a whole big community of people who much of their work is classified, but whose goal is to get it, accomplish a particular objective on a particular program, whether it's building a nuclear airplane, testing a nuclear rocket engine. And it's the nuclear part that I've realized that these ancient academics and fossilized physicists have no idea that there's something beyond chemical rockets. You can't get here from there. The head of the Hayden Planetarium stupidly said, and I'd say that to his face, that, look, our fastest vehicle, a Voyager spacecraft, would take 70,000 years to get to the next star. What a stupid thing to say. It doesn't have a propulsion system on it. It's been floating, if you will, coasting. Chemical rockets are not the be-all and end-all chemical reactions. That's like saying fossil fuel is it, for goodness sakes. And I will point out that many people don't seem to be aware. World War II, a big bomb, was a 10-ton blockbuster. B-29s would carry those, mm-hmm. and they make quite a mess below, you know. But that was World War II. Okay, come Hiroshima, suddenly the ante is up. That's the equivalent of 15,000 tons of TNT. That's a pretty good jump.
Yes, it is.
In a short period of time. Well, let's go beyond that. We figured out, I mean, look at the rapid pace. We didn't even discover there were neutrons until 1932. They've been here all the time, you understand, long before we knew them about them. We figured out that probably the process that produces the energy of the stars is nuclear fusion. That was in 1938, theoretical. We put it to use in 1952. We exploded our first H-bomb. Now, Hiroshima was 15,000 tons of TNT equivalent energy release. Mike, out in the Pacific, 10 million tons of TNT equivalent.
Yeah, it's just
one bomb.
Mind-boggling.
And the Russians exploded one that was 57 million tons. And the kicker about this is, I worked on fusion propulsion systems. We did a study of it at Aerojet General Nucleonics back in the early 60s. And here's why. In the first place, every advanced civilization is going to know about fusion because that's what makes its star work. That's the big source of energy on the block, so to speak.
Yep.
In the second place, if we use the right stuff in the right way, and it just happens to be isotopes of hydrogen and helium, which is very convenient, these are the two most abundant substances in the universe. You may not find uranium everywhere, but you're going to find hydrogen and helium everywhere. Okay, if you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end that have 10 million times as much energy per particle. 10 million
per
times.
Per particle?
Per particle, as you can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. 10 million times. So why would anybody in his right mind, especially in the astronomical community, be stuck at the level of chemical reactions? Do they still think the sun is a mass of burning gas? Lord Kelvin thought that around the turn of the 20th century, 1902 or something like that. Not more than 30,000 years or 30 million years, doesn't matter. He thought it was a chemical process. So what I'm getting at is, of course, this stuff was all done outside of academia. And these guys can't seem to understand that there's a new ball game out there. You know, it's not the Pony Express. It's the Internet that we're looking at now for information transfer. Friedman's Law, I named stuff after myself, you know. Technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. And
it's
also
Friedman's Law. Okay.
Yeah. when we recognize how young we are on a cosmic scale. I mean, go back to the year 1900. We hadn't flown an airplane. We hadn't fired a rocket. Electronics were non-existent. DNA, fission, fusion, all this stuff didn't exist as far as we were concerned. Now, there are stars in our local neighborhood that are at least a billion years older than the sun. I mean, I got kind of a shock. I suppose I shouldn't have. I was speaking to a couple of college classes in Detroit, the University of Detroit. And I went through how much things have changed within my lifetime and pointed out that when I started working in industry, I was using a slide rule. I looked around the class, didn't see any reaction at all. So finally, I asked, I said, anybody here know what a slide rule is? Not one student in the class. That was less than 50 years earlier. So we've come a long way, and I'm sure these SETI cultists, as I call them, aren't using slide rules. They're using terabyte computers, for God's sakes. I wonder how much, if they appreciate how remarkable an inexpensive computer that's sitting on my desk, less than $1,000, what that would have been like 50 years ago. I mean, incredible. I think of some of the brilliant professors I had at Chicago, Singh Chandrasekhar. He did all kinds of calculations about radiation transfer in stars, basically with desk calculators. And if he had only had a computer, much more he might have accomplished, you know, in just this short time frame. So my message to people is, A, that there's overwhelming evidence that some UFOs are alien spacecraft. B, that the reasons that it's not being taken seriously, besides the self-interest. I mean, let's face it, if aliens are visiting, who needs a radio telescope? Learn sign language, you know, if you want to find out about life out there. They're not looking for intelligence. They're looking for radio signals. And I love the assumption, and we've been treated to discussions about this past 9 months. The assumption is that aliens are sending signals to us using technology appropriate for our equipment and for our times. Now, why would anybody make such a stupid assumption?
Yeah, lifetime, it's hard to find anybody who knows Morse code anymore.
Yeah, that doesn't happen every day, right. And the thing is that Stephen Hawking, a great physicist, says they're not coming here because if they had, they'd have sent us a signal first. What are you going to send? Hey, we're bringing 30 guys for dinner, and we don't like pork. They're Jewish out there, of course. But, I mean, it's one of those utterly asinine notions that they would use technology appropriate to us when we've had such a short period of time. And look how, are they sending AM or FM? You know, digital or analog? And what will the question be 50 years from now?
That's an interesting analogy, the AM or FM. I know younger people who just don't know how to find the AM band.
What's an AM? The morning show, right, isn't it? AM, morning?
And now FM's suffering the same thing as they go digital. So
yeah, and it's going to all be different in not very long.
Very shortly.
Yeah, and what people forget, there is a transition time. I got boxes of vinyl records at home.
Same here. Can't find a player.
I did find one. Still haven't used them. But, what we're both agreeing on is that technology has been changing very rapidly in a few years. But if you got tens of hundreds, thousands, millions of years, and, this is as bad as the attitude about Copernicus. Now, you got to admire the guy's guts. He had this crazy idea, which he wouldn't let be published. The book came out in the year he died, 1543, in which he had the gall to suggest, how stupid, that the Earth isn't the center of the universe. The belief was that the Earth's the center and the sun and the other planets revolve around the Earth. Very straightforward. Copernicus said, no, the sun is the center of the universe. The book was banned for 300 years, for God's sakes, because everybody knew that was nonsense. That was stupid. Well, okay. These guys don't seem to understand that we are now no longer next to the center of the universe. The sun isn't the center of the universe either. And that we're not the big shots these guys would like to think we are. We're latecomers. It's the time factor. I mean, you know, you realize we didn't discover that there were such things as neutrons until 1932. You'd think they didn't exist before we discovered them, you know. We've been made of neutrons all this time. There are many other things we didn't know until very, very recently. And most of them, that was discovered at a university, but most of the technological stuff was done outside the university environment. So we have, there ought to be a PhD thesis here. You know, the sociological complications of aliens visiting Earth. And the Brookings Institute report, I hadn't fully appreciated this, said one of the things that would happen if there was contact with extraterrestrials, one of the groups most affected would be scientists. Because their power, their omnipotence, their being the big shots would suddenly be down the tubes.
Their answers are wrong.
Yeah. And I begin to appreciate that now. I look at the desperation with which these guys are talking about radio signals.
Well, we see this, Stanton, and not only in our field, but almost everything. The human brain likes to think it's a great pioneer, it's very egocentric, but for some reason they don't want to accept these new ideas. And I think part of it is that the establishment, they're making money, they're doing fine, they got a good reputation.
Status, yes. Well, there was a comment made by a German scientist, Max Planck. New ideas come to be accepted, not because their opponents come to believe in them, but because their opponents die and a new generation grows up that's accustomed to them. And that's what seems to happen, actually. They fight to their dying breath to defend the old way of looking at things.
We're talking with Stanton T. Friedman, and we are at Angel Fire, a great place in northern New Mexico. If you've never been here, you need to check it out. I'm Jerry Pippin, and Stanton, I had two things to ask you, and
sure.
We started, and I wanted to talk about the contemporary investigations of Stanton T. Friedman, but I want to go back now to the early years. Let's talk about that meeting with Jesse Marcel. You were at a television station, as I recall. Were you interested in this subject? Were you there doing a UFO show, or what were you doing?
Yeah, I got interested in flying saucers in 1958, read Ed Ruppelt's book, Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. He was head of Project Blue Book. And then the great discovery that set me off in a new direction was at the University of California, Berkeley Library. I mean, I'd read that one book, moved to California, had a good librarian, read 14 other books, some of which were utter trash, including one by Menzel, as a matter of fact. And there I am at the University of California, Berkeley. I was taking a course there, and so I'd stop off at the library. And I discovered the Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. That was Ruppelt's book. That was there, too. But the one I found was Project Blue Book Special Report 14. And here was data on 3,201 sightings. It was done for the Air Force. I didn't know who did it at that time. I found out later. They had quality evaluations, classification of all these sightings, statistical cross-comparison, 240 charts, tables, graphs, and maps. I was in data heaven. I like data. But the guy who put this together is Dr. Leon Davidson that I'd mentioned. Mm-hmm. He had included a copy of the press release that went out in October 1955. The government didn't release the report. They released the press release. The press release didn't say who did the work. They didn't say where the work was done, Battelle Memorial Institute, as I found out. They didn't give the title even. Surely some reporter, if they'd said 14, would have said, what happened to 1 through 13? We haven't heard anything about them. An honest answer, which wouldn't have been given, would have been that they were all classified. But the real kicker was a statement by the Secretary of the Air Force in this very widely distributed press release. On the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. That seems very straightforward. There's really nothing to this, just not enough data. But I had the report in front of me and was looking at the tables and the charts, and where'd that 3% come from? If you tabulate those 3,201 sightings, and they had categories like balloons and astronomical, you know, conventional stuff, psychological aberrations, crackpot cases, that was 1.5%, incidentally. Here were the unknowns. Were they 3%? No, they were 21.5%. That's not a misprint, you know, that's not a rounding off error. In addition, there was another category called insufficient information. If there wasn't enough data available about a sighting, it could not be listed as an unknown, and it's only the unknowns that we're interested in. There were 9.3% unknown, insufficient information. So that one shook me up. Look, I was working under security. I've been lecturing for, at that time, I hadn't given any lectures in 1960, but when you work under security, sometimes you are rather careful in what you say to avoid releasing classified information. There are certain rules, and you try not to lie, but you don't want to give out classified data either. But flat-out lying was something new to me, especially from the Secretary of the Air Force. So I was determined to get to the bottom of this. I joined APRO and NICAP. We talked about it, brown bagging lunches at the technical places that I work. And I gave my first lecture. It's hard to imagine looking back at my life, you know, what a strange way to start my public UFO career. Frank Edwards had published a book, Flying Saucer Serious Business, in the mid-60s. I was living in Indianapolis. I spent 3 years at each of several places as they canceled government-sponsored research and development programs. You know, see the country, work on radiation shielding for nuclear systems. You'll get a chance to change jobs every so often. Anyway, I'd gotten to know Frank in Indianapolis, and he sent me a copy of his new book. And I called him, and I said, Frank, you know everybody. He was a newsman, radio program, and he was active in NICAP and so on the board. I said, Frank, you know everybody. Here I am in Pittsburgh, work for Westinghouse. Give me some names. I'd like to speak out publicly. So he gave me a bunch of names. One of them was a producer of a talk show at KDKA Pittsburgh, one of the old-time radio stations, one of the biggest
famous station,
clear channel station. And so I called them. The guy was a producer of a show called, Would You Believe, Contact. I love the title in retrospect. And I gave him the pitch, you know, I'm a Westinghouse nuclear physicist. Normally that would mean something, but his was kind of, don't call us, we'll call you. Less than a month later, he called me at 6:30. Could I be on the show at 7 o'clock? I live near the station. It turns out somebody had canceled at the last minute, and I've often wondered, how many people did they call who couldn't make it before they finally got down to the bottom of the list, you know, call Friedman. So I did the show. And I wasn't as good then as I am now at handling nasty, noisy negatives. The show host didn't know what he was talking about, but I was too polite, frankly. But a woman at work, a technical assistant, was involved with a book review club, and the book they were reviewing was Frank's book. She asked me to give a talk to her club in her living room. That was my first lecture. I was on that show many times after that, did a whole bunch more lectures. Mostly the chicken and pea circuit, as I like to call it. You know, everybody needs a free program, and we'll give you dinner. sometimes you get gas, you know. And then another serendipitous event. I lived downtown Pittsburgh. Westinghouse, where I worked, was out of town. And one of 2 days, we'd take turns, people who had to leave their car in a garage, you know, and they'd drive the other, pick them up and drop them off later. Going into work with Joanne, PhD, supervisor at Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab. And I'm telling her, you know, I'd really like to speak at Carnegie Mellon University. She says, why don't you talk to the dean? I said, well, I talked to Dr. So-and-so, and he wasn't interested. She said, Stan, the dean's my husband. He's heard you on the radio. Give him a call. Okay. So I did, and he booked me. We set up a date, but it was a daytime talk, and I knew I'd have to take some time off work. So he finally asked, how much do you want? I thought, well, how about $100, thinking he'd knock me down to 50. This is back in the 60s, you understand. Sold, and then because I knew his wife, he told me what he was paying the other speakers in this series, 1,500, 1,600, 1,800. Well, the talk went very well. He sent a letter to the agency. They booked me at a key talk for me, Engineering Society of Detroit. This is not a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes, hard-nosed engineers. Turns out they were sold out 3 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk. And there wasn't one negative attack of any kind.
Now, what year was this?
This would have been, 68, maybe.
Okay.
And so, funny thing, I asked management, I said, look, I'd like to do more lectures, but I've got a security clearance, I've got a wife, I've got a house, I've got a kid, mortgage, I don't want to lose any of these things. I need some guidance. What can I do and what can't I do? I don't want somebody to come to me, well, we don't like what you've been doing, so you're fired, kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
You're casting a bad light on the company or something like that. So my boss's boss's boss, somebody comes back with the guidance. Three things, Stan. You can say what you please on your time. You can identify yourself as a Westinghouse nuclear physicist. But we would like you to start each lecture with a disclaimer. The views you're about to hear are mine and mine alone and not those of my employer. What more could you ask for? Well, something more. I get a call from an associate at Los Alamos, also working on nuclear rockets. Hey, Stan, how about speaking to the local chapter of the American Nuclear Society? I said, oh, I'd love to. Well, I mean on an expense account, Stan. So I don't make those decisions. I'm in Pittsburgh. He's in New Mexico, you know. So I talked to management, and they said yes. I mean, Westinghouse is a corporate member of the American Nuclear Society. I'm a member of the American Nuclear Society. But still, they didn't have to say yes. So I went out there with everybody knowing I was there to give a lecture, Flying Saucers Are Real, to the Los Alamos section of the American Nuclear Society. We had 500 people there. For them, a very big crowd. No negative reactions at all. So when it came time to get off the business of working 3 years, 3 years, 3 years, you know, they weren't spending money anymore and stuff that I was interested in. I finally went full-time in 1970. Never really turned back. I've done some technical work along the way. But but what I found, several things. I'm not a masochist. I found that the response was extremely good. And I come on very, very strong. I'm not an apologist, ufologist. I found that not only are people interested, but they're attentive, they're curious, but they're fearful of ridicule. As strong as I come on, I've only had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures, and two of them were drunk. So, you know, you're going to get that many if you talk
like
about sports, religion, politics,
right,
whatever.
I'd like to have that record. I used to do stand-up comedy. I would like
Oh, boy. Somebody asked me the other night, I don't know whether he was kidding or not, Stan, this was in Exeter, you given any thought to doing stand-up comedy? And I don't know whether that was a compliment or not, But
well, you're an entertaining guy, so let's say it was a compliment.
I do bring to the subject several things. One of them is I worked on far-out propulsion systems, which gets to the heart of the question, can you get here from there or not? Mm-hmm. Second, I worked under security, so I know about keeping secrets and stuff. Third, as it turns out, for most of my life, I've had a very good memory, so I could give you an answer now. I don't say I'll get back to you tomorrow. This isn't a question and answer period. Fourth, people are willing to accept data, but what they really want to know is why. Why would aliens come here? Why doesn't the government tell us what it knows? Why don't they land on the White House lawn, stuff like that? And the usual response when I give my answers is, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. So I'm playing to my strength. Now, there was a very important moment in my childhood. Fifth grade, Rose Gutkin was teaching us about science. And the sun stands still, and the planets move around the sun. Well, I just read, we were buying the encyclopedia one volume at a time from the supermarket. I think it was 49 cents a volume or something. This is a very long time ago. And I said, no, Miss Gutkin. Now, I didn't sass teachers. I was an A student. I said, no, the whole solar system's moving around the galaxy at 12 miles a second, which seemed horribly fast to me, you know. No, that isn't right. She gave me a hard time. And I wasn't accustomed to somebody coming down hard. I mean, not a teacher. So the next day I brought in the volume of the encyclopedia. And she very reluctantly admitted, well, maybe that was right. But it taught me a lesson. If you're going to take on authority figures, have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear, or they'll chop your head off, you know. So I've tried to stick by that. And I, other people who want to speak out, I say, look, there are a couple of basic rules. Do your homework first. Never lie to an audience.
Okay.
You may get away with it for a while, but I don't think it's good policy. Stick to the fact. And don't be afraid to say, I don't know. Basic rules. So I have enjoyed being a performer, a stand-up, if you will. I've enjoyed doing radio and television. You know, there are times when you get upset about, well, it did Ted Koppel's Nightline. It was the, 40th anniversary of Kenneth Arnold's sighting. I was in Washington for a MUFON conference, and they had Phil Klass and I on. And we're going to be talking about government cover-up. Now, the show was a little shorter than it had to be because Jackie Gleason had died that day, so they had to spend a few minutes on him. But when we went in there, I've got a bunch of blacked-out documents. We're talking about government cover-up. See, here's the proof. Oh, you can't bring anything in. Why not? Well, that's not how we do things here. And you argue a little bit and you lose, you know. And then the circumstances. They put me facing a camera and Phil 2 feet away from me facing a camera. Don't look at each other. Now, how can you argue with somebody and not look at them? You know, it might as well be by radio, by phone, you know. And so we went at it, and people next day at the MUFON conference asked me, how did it go? I said, I don't know. You're on the show. I said, look, I don't know what you saw. I don't know what the audience saw. We each have a camera. Well, how was Ted? I don't know. Never saw him. Well, didn't you see him on a monitor? No. I heard him through my ear. Now, you denied all the nonverbal cues that you and I sitting here, I can see when you raise an eyebrow, you know,
right,
and stuff
right.
like that. It's a strange way to do stuff. And then you get the dishonest people. I get a call from a guy in California, Southern California. They're doing a show on abductions and for Dick Clark. Now, if you can't trust Dick Clark, who can you trust, you know? They'd done most of the show, but they needed to sharpen it up a little bit. Could I come out? And they'd ask me questions. And, okay, I have a daughter in Southern California. I don't often get a chance to see her, so this would be a chance to see my daughter. Okay, and they asked me a whole bunch of questions. I gave them answers. They must have liked them because they used a lot of them on the show. What the show basically was, they had this cockamamie story that this family in Minnesota had encounters with aliens and had filmed it, and the film was found later. How exciting, you know. And they would have my comments. They'd ask about electromagnetic effects, and I would talk about them. Then they'd show something happening in the story. And I was used and abused, but good. And people came down on me. Oh, Stan, how could you get involved with that? And I said, well, you know, that's not the story I was told. Nobody asked me about that footage. But they cleverly intercut what I said with what was there. And
we'll try not to do that. We're talking with Stanton T. Friedman, and we'll try to be honest here in our approach.
I trust you, Jerry.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back and wrap this up. I've got a big question for you, and that is basically, why did Jesse Marcel finally come clean, start talking about all this? We'll be right back. I'm Jerry Pippin. I don't know if you've noticed, probably most people have, when they come to jerrypippin.com. Sometimes you click on something and voila, you're at another website. We have two companion websites and they're designed specifically for specific use. iPodShows.net simply is all of our programming available as a podcast MP3. Don't worry, if you're one of those Windows PC people, we have links for that as well, even there on that site. Come and see us. All of our programming is on demand, and it's free, advertisers supported, 24/7. You get anybody here have a question for Stanton Friedman?
Yes, sir.
You want to ask him?
Yes, we did.
Okay. Okay, let me get over there, and we'll do about 10 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. What was Ted Koppel like? I think he was in Timbuktu. No. Oh, no. It was about a family... In Minnesota, the abduction of the McGriffin family or something like that. And, you know, they showed nice green grass in Minnesota in the winter. You're not going to find it.
And that's Stanton T. Friedman going a little bit further about what Dick Clark Productions did to him. Another thing, Stanton, they did to you I thought was highly unfair was the Peter Jennings special.
Oh, boy.
And it appeared to me that there was two different specials going on there. The first part of that program looked pretty straightforward, and then somebody came in and talked to somebody or something.
Well, you know, that was a terrible experience, really.
It had to be.
Another one. I call it the Peter Jennings mockumentary. I mean, okay, I'm in Roswell. They want to talk to me. We go down to the art museum there. Nice art museum. Good setting. Guy asked me questions for over an hour. Good questions. This was a sensible, straightforward kind of discussion. I knew I was in trouble, though, when after we'd wrapped up, he said, Stan, don't you think if these things were real that half the academics and scientists would be working on UFOs? I said, absolutely not. Those who can do, those who can't teach. You know, and we talked about this earlier, that of course they wouldn't be going to academics. But we did over an hour interview. Turns out they interviewed 150 people. Only 50 of us made the cut. That included John Mack didn't make the cut. A whole bunch of PhDs, and I'll give you why I think they did this. But I got 20 seconds. They called me, and what was that word, an operator, twice. They said the witnesses just came out of the woodwork. You know, there was nothing to it. And I was really angry because one was a personal reason. I had thought I'd do better with Peter Jennings. I liked his work. I'd seen a program he did on the Catholic Church in old days, and I thought he did a fine job on it. Also, we're both born on July 29th, and we were both dual citizens of the United States and Canada. So I thought I ought to get a fair shake out of him, you know, if nothing else. I'd forgotten, I checked later, Benito Mussolini was also born on July 29th. But here's the kicker on this show. They had a lot of money. They spent a lot of money. They came to the MUFON conference. John Shushu set them up with a whole bunch of people. They didn't use any of it. You know, they used Peter Davenport as if he was the only investigator in the country working on UFO stuff. Why do you interview 150 people? For a two-hour show, minus commercials, you know, that's not a lot of time. And so I have a conspiracy theory. Somebody said, how are we going to find out what these idiots in ufology know? Do they know anything useful? Are they going to expose us? Well, I know one way you could do it, says one of the guys. Give them a chance to be on a documentary with one of the big three news guys, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS. They'd all want to. They all like to see their face on the tube. And so they arrange all these interviews. Like I say, 150. And, you know, as part of that, they asked me if I had any footage from television with me in it. I was like, I got loads of hunks of film, but I don't have time to go through that. Well, send it to us. We'll do it. I sent them 56 or 7 VHS tapes. They did send them back. What the hell did they do with all that stuff? There was some good stuff about Roswell on there, I'll tell you that. And so I thought it was disgraceful, that it really was. They attacked Roswell. They attacked abductions. They cut out most of what Bud Hopkins had said. They had Susan Clancy saying stupid things about why people think they were abducted, sleep paralysis and stuff like that. You know, Betty and Barney Hill were obviously sleeping when they were driving in New Hampshire, you know. What was the purpose of the show? You're right, the first part was very good, and the rest was, there was garbage. They should have, I was glad about one thing. It was only seen by 14 million people. The Unsolved Mysteries program that I had instigated back in 89 was seen by 28 million people the first time around and 30 million the second time. So there, Peter, take that.
Yeah, take it. I think your theory, your hypothesis about what they were doing is probably correct. And who at ABC knew about it and who didn't, that's another question.
That is another question. And, you know, people forget, in all honesty, there have been times in the past when the media have been asked to cooperate. The word uranium was forbidden to be used during World War II. We could not talk about Fugo balloons. They didn't want the Japanese to know whether they'd done any damage or not. And it's the kind of article that would have been picked up, you know, balloon explodes, family hurt, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not that the media hasn't gone along. The New York Times knew about the Cuban Missile business. And Jack Kennedy once said he wished they had published it, you know, because then it would have stopped, yeah. You know. So, you know, it's not a conspiracy. There's no question the government's been lying, misrepresenting, and, you know, in short, not being honest with its citizens. Now, you asked me about Jesse Marcel.
Yeah, I was going to get to that.
Okay, get to it.
Yeah, okay, it basically is, why did he talk to you?
Well, you know, I've had a lot of people say, why did all those guys, and it's not just Jesse, a bunch of other witnesses, come running to you, Friedman? And the answer is they didn't. Jesse didn't come to me.
I know you seeked him out, and well, you worked at it.
Here's the kicker. I'm at a television station doing a promotion, three interviews, supposedly, concerning my lecture that night at Louisiana State University. And I'd done two, and the third reporter was nowhere to be found. This is before cell phones. So the station manager, who's arranged all this stuff, he knew the person who brought me to the station. He's apologetic. He's giving me coffee. He's looking at his watch. You know, where the heck is this darn reporter? And out of the blue, because he knows I have other things to do and I can't stay here forever, you know, out of the blue he says, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. And me, being the brilliant investigator I am, I said, who's he? And his answer floored me. Well, he handled wreckage of one of those saucers you were interested in when he was in the military. What? Where'd that come from? You know, totally out of the blue, literally. I said, well, what do you know about him? Where is he? Is he alive? Yeah, he lives down in Houma. I'll admit, I didn't know where Houma, Louisiana was. I've been there since, and it's a pretty good-sized town. He's a great guy. We're old ham radio buddies. Give him a call. And then the reporter showed up, the one who had been late. So I did our interview, did the program that night, and things went extremely well. We had a great crowd, very friendly crowd. So the next day from the airport, I was there a little early. I thought, you know, I ought to give that a try. So I call information in Houma. This is before the internet, you know, you didn't go quickly. There was a listing for a Jesse Marcel, and I called him. And I used the name Bill Allen of the television guy, station guy. And so Jesse's one of the few people that couldn't deny he was involved. His name shows up in papers all over the place, even in China and in England and so forth. His picture's in a lot of papers, too. So he told me a story. He couldn't deny it, and he wasn't going to be a liar about it. Oh, I don't know anything about that, you know. And I came with a good reference, Alan. So he told me a story. He didn't know the exact date, though. I mean, he's the intelligence officer of the 509th in Roswell. So it's the kind of thing you sort of file. What am I going to do now? Well, what I did was, a few months later, I'm in Bemidji, Minnesota, and somebody comes up to me after the lecture. You ever hear anything about a crash saucer in New Mexico? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I have. I didn't tell him what I had heard, but so he tells me his story, and that relates, as it turns out, to the Plains of St. Augustine case. The guy who was the engineer, Barney Barnett. His first name isn't Barney, but Barney Barnett. And he had, the person who was talking to me, had Barney's niece, his wife's niece's number and address. So I took that information. I shared them with Bill Moore the next day, who lived in Minnesota. Bill had a third story. It was beginning to get interesting. There was an article in the Flying Saucer Review, an English publication, and talks about an English actor driving across the country in the United States, hearing on the radio about a crash saucer in New Mexico. and thinking there'd be a big fuss when he got back to Philadelphia, and there was nothing. So that guy, his son lived in Canada, I guess, and Bill talked to him. Anyway, he got a date. It wasn't a trip you made very often. You can imagine what the roads were like back in 1947. You know, no highway system. It was a mess. Almost as bad as part of the road up here to Angel Fire. And so I've talked to that actor. He's dead now, Huey Green. Anyway, he could pin down the date because it wasn't a trip he made often, early July 47. So Bill went to the University of Minnesota Library, Periodicals Department, started looking in July 47, and there's the story. With Jesse Marcel's name, of course, and giving us a bunch of other names. Walter Hout, spelled four different ways, I might add. And Blanchard and, you know, the whole crew. So from that point on, we spent about a year and a half tracking down 62 people. And in almost all cases, it was you called Joe and you remember anybody else who was there. If you get him talking for 5 or 10 minutes, at first he'll say, oh, no, it was a long time ago. I don't remember anybody. You get him back into that time frame of reference. Hey, have you talked to Bill Smith or John Johnson or whatever? And a lot of the wives had Christmas lists, Christmas card lists. The military guys tended to stick together a bit. So we tracked down 62 people. That led to the first book, The Roswell Incident, by Berlitz and Charles Berlitz and William Moore. I got a percentage of the royalties, so they acknowledged my contribution, if you will. And Bill and I kept at it. By 1986, we had found 92 people. And then I instigated the Unsolved Mysteries program, seen by 28 million people. And believe it or not, it was very strange. They didn't give out their toll-free number during the Roswell segment on that for some reason. There are two other short segments, a half hour in Roswell and two other short segments. They gave it out for if anybody knows where somebody is, you know. And they got dozens of calls from people about Roswell. People heard about it from a neighbor, a cousin, somebody else had talked to him about it. So that led to Don Berliner and my book and so forth. But in no case were people running to us. And, well, sometimes you get lucky. But luck is what happens when you're ready for it. I check editor and publisher. There's a newspaper in Roswell. I didn't know that. Okay. I didn't know anything about Roswell. The Roswell Daily Record. So I call the record and explain, I'm looking for the editor from 1947. Long gone, what do you need? Well, I tell her, I've got this article. It talks about the base public information officer. I didn't even know the base had been closed for years already. A guy named Walter Hout, his name is spelled four different ways. And before I could finish the sentence, his wife works here. What? You don't expect a GI who was there in 47 to still be there, you know, in 79. And I talked to his wife, and I talked to Walter. He had a base yearbook. So you can say I was lucky. Another time, I want to find anybody named Brazel. And again, I call information, no internet. And, you know, only one area code for New Mexico at that time, of course. And you were always talking to somebody who was in the area code, not like today where they're off some next to some computer somewhere. And so you can ask questions like, is that a nice part of town, or things like that. I want to find anybody named Brazel. What city? I don't know, but southeastern New Mexico, I'd say. Well, I've got a William in Carrizozo. I said, is that in southeastern New Mexico? Well, I didn't know. Yes, it is. It turns out that was the son of the rancher. And I pass it on to Bill, and he called him. And said, he had tried that like 2 weeks earlier, and Brazel had just gotten his phone. We lucked out, you could say.
Yeah, it's according to who you get as the operator. Very lucky sometimes. Some of these information operators, others overlook it.
Well,
we've tried that technique a lot.
Back then, you know, people who worked for the phone company then were different than now. They didn't have much competition, and they took themselves seriously. And I've had good luck back then. Sometimes today with the www.411.com, they can drive you up the wall.
Basically, Jesse Marcel talked to you and told you the truth, but he was reluctant. Would you say that?
Well, he certainly hadn't come running to me.
Okay.
And I talked to him later on, and then because I was working on a movie, UFOs Are Real, I was able. He was one of the people we wanted to interview, so we visited him in Houma, Louisiana. I filmed
and
him sitting right at his ham radio rig.
Hopefully, the same thing will happen with this Magic Man movie.
Well,
Magic
that's
Man.
That's right, Magic Man. And what I'm hoping. Look, let me give you another example of what I'm hoping for. I figured out that, gee, maybe Thomas Jefferson Dubose is alive, and maybe he's shown in the picture with General Ramey, with those pieces of junk on Ramey's floor, you know. I figured if he was a colonel at that time, he was probably a West Pointer, because they stayed in after the war. They didn't get out. So I called West Point, and yes, he was alive. And they didn't tell me exactly where he was, but it was in the South. Eventually, I found him, and I called him, and then I visited him. My folks were retired in Florida. He lived in Florida. So I met with him twice, and he said something in our last conversation. He liked the work I'm doing. If I remember anything more, I'll let you know. What can they do to me now? He was 87. So the kind of thing you're hoping for something like Magic Man.
Understand.
Is somebody who will say, what can they do to me now? I typed a document, or I filed reports, or whatever. And the thing is that I found people are decent. For example, I would get people, find their picture in the yearbook, I'd send them a copy of the picture. That whole page would have people that they worked with, you know. They were grateful. And I swore I wouldn't use their name without permission and stuff like that. And I don't. So you have to respect people is what I'm saying, especially older people. I mean, I can say that now that I'm older, but, you know.
Dennis Balthaser, I always get his name wrong. Dennis Balthaser.
That's right.
Did I get close?
Close enough.
Okay, good. You have known Stanton a long time, and you're here in the audience. You're here with your own job. You're emceeing this time.
I am, and I'm finding it's a lot harder than just doing a lecture.
Yeah, you told me sometime back that you were still working on it.
I am. I had to do all the bios, get the bios, and work up the introductions. And I'm looking forward to it because we got some good speakers this year, and it's a new experience for me. I worked with Stanton off and on for the last 12, 13 years, and I can relate to what he's talking about with the media problems, because him and I both had a situation with the National Geographic a couple of years ago where we spent hours taping with them, and the last thing the announcer said was that Roswell was a myth. So you never know what the editor's going to do.
He obviously had seen Peter Jennings' show.
I guess. I don't know. But
this program will be broadcast on Friday. Stanton, your speech is what time?
Friday at 7 o'clock.
So you have plenty of time to get down here. If you're in northern New Mexico, a scenic drive, to say the least, disregard what Stanton said about the highways. They're not bad.
No. And Southern Colorado, too. We look for people to come down from up in Colorado. We'll probably have some come up from Texas and over from Arizona. So we're looking for a good symposium.
And you have a question for Stanton?
No, just keep doing what you're doing.
Well, Stanton's an old media guy. He knows we got to sneak in a plug some way, Stanton. We just did it.
Well, yeah. and let me give my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. You get all my books with autographs, mind you, which you don't get from Amazon.com. No charge for the autograph. That's right.
anyone else have a question for Stanton? We have but several people in the audience. Anybody have a question at all? Okay, they're all bashful. They don't.
I like my roast beef rare.
Stanton, it's always a pleasure having you on. Anything that we haven't covered, we need to do?
No, I think what is important right now is to realize how important for people on this planet to begin thinking of themselves as Earthlings instead of all those nationalistic labels. Nationalism has got us in one heck of a lot of trouble. That's what the wars are about. I've got a great-grandson. I'd like him to grow up in a more peaceful world than I've been fortunate enough to grow up in. And I think a big part of that is recognizing we're part of a galactic neighborhood. not just one country or one continent. And I'm hopeful. I'm an optimist still.
Thanks very much. And one final question about Magic 12. Something like that still exists, I'm sure.
Well, I'm sure the name has been changed. When classified names get out, you
probably
change the name.
Probably it's Magic 36 now or something.
Yeah, the whole point is you need an organization like that to be at the hub of that Western wagon wheel without a rim. The spokes bring information in, but not around. You need some place that has to coordinate the technical data you get from wreckage, the observational data you get from airplanes chasing UFOs, radar information, all that sort of stuff. Somebody to put it all together. I'm sure that group still exists. I wish they'd give me a call.
And you can find him on www.whitepages, probably. Well, just go to your website, stanfriedman.com.
Stantonfriedman.com.
Thanks very much, Stan. It's always a pleasure. I'd like to take an opportunity here to talk about our websites. We've been adding programs and adding programs, and sometimes it's difficult to find what you're looking for. First of all, we have a search mechanism on each of our websites, and you can click, like if it's jerrypippin.com or if ipodshows.net, just search the websites, put in the name of what you're looking for, and it will come up. Check us out, won't you? Often. One of the great things of doing these shows on location is you get to meet people face-to-face, and occasionally we run across, I call him the boy creative genius who now is no longer a boy. John Greenwald, how are you?
I'm good. I still like to think I'm a boy in a way.
It must have been a great John Greenwald Sr. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, that's my dad. Actually, it's not a legal name. The junior is not legal. I had to adopt that when I was 15. My dad, who is also John Greenwald, again, not officially a senior, worked for a defense contractor. He worked for Boeing, worked on the space shuttle. And what I found out after, worked on a couple other programs as well. So I didn't want the government and military to think that I was requesting all this top secret information and I was my dad.
You'd be his dad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So I didn't want him to get in trouble. So I adopted the junior on my name, and I would put my high school student ID in every Freedom of Information Act request I would send out. So that's how I...
As a high school student, you refine that to a fine art. I think you were doing as well as anybody getting information.
I appreciate that. Yeah, when I started when I was 15, it was quite a learning process for sure. The Freedom of Information Act, I'm telling you, is not easy to really use. The process is simple, but all the games that the government plays, the military plays, I just got an article published about 5 months ago that says that was about me waiting 11 years for one document to come. That's a long time to wait for a single document.
It certainly is.
Yeah, so...
And you wonder how they justify that.
They can't.
Against the law.
Yeah, they can't.
The law is pretty explicit.
It's pretty cut and dry in that they've got 20 business days right now to respond to a FOIA request. But that means that they could just send you a postcard or send you an initial response that says, we received your request, we're going to process it. The issue then is now, once they responded, they can wait 11 years if they wanted to, if not longer. There's a couple active Freedom of Information Act requesters that I stay in frequent contact with, and we talk a lot about what are the time frames of some of our oldest requests, and I still have a couple out that are more than a decade right now, and
wow.
It's frustrating. So,
do you think when they created and Congress wrote this law, this is unintended consequences of the bureaucrats figuring out how... Yeah, we'll send them a postcard, tell them we're working on it, and forget it. Or do you think they knew that to begin with?
Well, I'm
always looking for unintended consequences.
I mean, I'll be honest. I'm an optimist. I want to think that these are paid government workers that are overloaded and swamped with work. And, then therein lies my second point that, you know, as much as I want to be an optimist, you got to look at the reality that why would it take 11 years, 10 years to process a request? It just shouldn't take that a large amount of time. Even when some of the agencies were in their biggest case backload, meaning they were 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 cases in, 5,000 cases had to be closed before they would get to mine, you were still only looking at a few years. So really, really, I'm not sure why they take the time that they do.
I think because they figured out they can do it. But maybe
and they can get away with it. Yeah, I mean, there's really nothing I can do except sue them and take them to court. I can appeal it and say that they're unresponsive. But what are they going to say? They'll say that they're processing my request. So the only option I have is to spend the money to take them then to court to make them answer in a timely manner. And again, when it comes down to it, if there's 3,000 cases ahead of mine that takes 9.5 years to process, I'm just more broke than I was when I originally started the court case. So that would be the only benefit to do that. So really,
any agency work with you at all promptly?
You know, not. I wouldn't say anything sticks out as being fast. More. Yeah, I don't think fast and government go in the same sentence at all. I would say, though, that some agencies are a little bit better than others. I would say I have got pretty good luck with the Defense Intelligence Agency that some of, not all of them, but some of the requests will come back in a timely manner. The National Security Agency, though, I mean, they're tough right now for me to deal with. And the reason is they're playing games with the Freedom of Information Act with me, trying to charge me a lot of money per request because they think that I'm not a representative of the news media. And by their own words in the law, I run my own radio network, not only my own radio show. I produce, direct, and write for major cable television programs like History Channel, Discovery Channel. So I'm a producer as well. And write articles that get published in newspapers, magazines throughout the country safely and sometimes around the world. What part of that doesn't make me a representative of the news media? Now, I'm not saying that for ego purposes. I'm saying that I should be able to fit in this category, and they shouldn't charge me what they are. And the National Security Agency...
Have you ever appealed that?
That's the process that I'm at right now. Okay. The appeal has gone on for well over a year. I think it's about 2 years now. They promised me a response by last September in 2009.
When you appeal something like that, where does it go? It doesn't go to the court there in L.A.?
No. Well, at the appeal level, it doesn't go to the court yet. That's the third step. Mm-hmm. At this point, I can legally take them to court to make them finalize my appeal because it's getting ridiculous. They told me again in September 2009 they'd have an answer for me.
So any federal court or you got to have jurisdiction?
I can file in Southern California.
Okay.
And so I'm kind of looking into that right now exploring how I can really do that. Again, it's money, so I'm not sure how much I can really afford that to take the NSA, and in fact it would be a lawsuit that would take the National Security Agency, the Department of Defense, and the Central Intelligence Agency to court. I would do it all under one case, and the reason is because the CIA is trying to charge me $250 every time I write them a letter. That is ridiculous, and there's absolutely no grounding for them to do that. So going back to my original thought, the Freedom of Information Act process is very simple and should be that. Unfortunately, it is so complicated and convoluted with all of their games and, hey, let's make Greenwald pay $250 every time he files a request to the CIA or we'll throw the request out. That's ridiculous. That completely cuts off the CIA.
Political route to find out why are these bureaucrats taking this long to your congressman or something?
Yeah, in fact, Senator Dianne Feinstein years ago, probably about 10, 11 years ago, Senator Dianne Feinstein went to the Central Intelligence Agency on my behalf, and she wanted to make sure that they were going to respond to my request. Now, of course, the CIA responded, and then a couple days thereafter, they wrote me another letter and said, we got Senator Feinstein's letter. Our letters crossed in the mail. We were absolutely responding to you. There was no need to contact her. Likely story, right. So Senator Feinstein, you know, was gracious enough to do that for me. Now I've got a more complicated problem. Now they're putting me into this category that I shouldn't fit in. Now I don't have any option but to take them to court. I went to Senator Feinstein again about a year ago, and she won't respond. So unfortunately, she helped nine years ago. She won't help anymore.
Well, maybe they got to her since then.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, maybe they just don't want her to help. I don't understand.
You really laid it out last night in your keynote speech about this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about what you talked about?
With the Freedom of Information Act?
Well, the whole term of speech. You talked about the U.S. government.
Well, I started with the U.S. government because really what I tried to do with my presentation here is kind of lay the groundwork for evidence that the UFO phenomenon, number one, is real. I think anybody can conclude that, but what are they? And that the real only logical explanation for the true unknown cases are that they're extraterrestrial in nature. And my forte is obviously government documents, so what I did in the presentation is bring up a lot of the documents that you can sometimes read and sometimes not read, meaning they are completely blacked out in some cases. There are thousands of examples of that. And then in other cases, you can read amazing UFO stories that you just have to scratch your head and go, okay, if they're trying to tell me in one breath that they can explain every UFO case out there and that they don't investigate them, and nearly a decade thereafter they have just one case that you can pull out that absolutely defies any logic that we know of even in 2010, it makes you really kind of wonder. And so I kind of take the audience through a journey of laying that groundwork, again, starting with the government, talking about the Freedom of Information Act and the games that they play, talking about the documents that have come out that have corroborated other UFO cases, that one UFO sighting in 1985 that yielded a little piece that he had obtained after it fell off of a UFO and it stayed in his trunk for a decade and his attic for a few more years thereafter, that documents from the 1940s labeled flying saucers from Denmark has an object almost identical to this man's that was found 40 plus years later. So it's a fascinating topic when you really get into all the pieces of the puzzle when you talk about the government and the documents that they've released. So then I also talk about my experiences with the media. As a director and producer, you know, I always try and dispel the myth, even though I didn't get into it that much in this presentation, but dispel the myth.
I want to hear about this.
Yeah, dispel the myth that there is a conspiracy or a cover-up when it comes to television and putting UFO information out there. I don't believe that. I've been a producer long enough now, produced well over 10 hours worth of UFO programming for History Channel, and even outside of the UFO realm, but very controversial topics. And there's never been a phone call or an email or a letter from a network executive going, by the way, John, you're a little bit too close to the truth here. Back off a little bit. It's quite the opposite. If we have evidence to show, and it's legitimate, if we can put that on screen, they'll absolutely go for it. It's quite the opposite.
No, that's my experience, too.
Yeah, but I think what we truly see, no offense to my colleagues in Los Angeles and Hollywood and New York, is that you really see the stupidity and ignorance of a lot of the producers out there when you see a UFO show. I've seen firsthand producers, you know, come in and they've never produced a UFO show before. They've only heard the term UFO on their cable TV once or twice.
Yeah, hey, it's hot, let's do it.
And so in some of their defense, it's very hard to get into this field and make sense of it. It is. I mean, it's 60 plus years of research from different mindsets and so on and so forth. So that in that respect, it's very difficult. But in the other end, they just want to make an entertaining show, and for them, it's making fun of the topic or just doing the brief overview of some of the stuff we hear about all the time. That's why we hear the same stories on TV, because they can't go any deeper. They don't go any deeper. So really, it's ignorance. It's not a conspiracy or cover-up. It's ignorance. I'm very lucky. I come from the UFO community, fell into producing and directing, and was able to kind of get beyond those surface cases, again, those ones that we hear about, and talk about the cases that really aren't heard about on TV. And again, I bring up the 1985 case, the Bob White encounter, and anybody can Google this. You'll come up with the photographs, and you'll even see references to the Black Vault because of the documents that their research team, they found them on my site, and then that's how we met. We've been, you know, friends and colleagues ever since. So it's very interesting to really get into that evidence. And when it comes to TV, that's what I always try and tell people: hey, there's no cover up or conspiracy.
You got any TV projects in mind? It's a little slow right now.
It's very slow in Hollywood. The economy has.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, the economy has hit pretty much every part of this country, including TV. And what's very hard to give you an idea is that when I was producing some of these shows four years ago, we would have staffs of people, researchers, a couple people under me. I'm not saying we had an office full of people, but we had a couple people. Uh-huh. Now I turned down a recent job offer for a major network, And it was only because I had to do it by myself. I couldn't hire anybody. It was like they were going to give me maybe the office janitor to print out some stuff if I needed it, and that was it. I had to do it in about 25% of the time that I was also normally used to producing and writing these shows. So when you chop off, which they are, they're chopping off about 33% of the entire budget for these shows. It suffers from the top down, from the quality of the show to the work load and everything.
I think reflect that.
Absolutely, because your choices on television are, you know, unfortunately bad productions. You know, it suffers. It's when you don't have the money to put on screen, let alone hire good people to make the show, it suffers. So that's my long-winded way of saying there's really not much going on for me in TV right now, simply for that reason. Now, for years, I've wanted to do a Black Bolt television series, a show.
Seems like a great concept. I don't know why somebody has just thrown money at you.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I would be a firm supporter in that. I think the issue with that is, in a production sense, it's very hard to make black and white documents interesting for television. Yeah. Now, the stories themselves are absolutely compelling. They're some of the best stories you could tell on yeah, exactly. But with government documents, that's very dry. So to a network executive, I think it's a little hard to see the visual element. Could the show work? Absolutely. And I had it optioned out, and I'm just getting the option rights back this month. And so I'm going to turn around and try and sell it myself and do it right, because I'm kind of tired of trusting those that, you know, talk big until you sign the bottom line, and that's it.
We could talk for hours, John, but you have to move on here. Mm-hmm. But I want to ask you about your radio activities here. You seem to have pretty neat little, I guess, I want to call it a network, but it's on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
You may have some other stations downloading.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you got a pretty neat idea there.
Yeah. In brief, about 6 years ago, I started the Black Vault Radio Network. And the Black Vault Radio Network was a collection of 39 shows that I was syndicating across the globe. It was an internet station, but you can go on and download on-demand radio, stream it, exactly. After that, though, to be blatantly honest, I'm one guy. It was very hard for finding the man hours to do that. So what I did was I redesigned the entire.
People don't realize how many man hours it takes.
That's right. It's very time laboring.
You figured the shortcut and it's working.
Well, so far, I mean, it's brand new. It's called BV Media, which actually now it absorbed Black Vault Radio Network, but also I'm able to stream online lectures. And on there, it's packed full of free radio, just like before. And there's also some pay-per-view or pay-per-listen content where people can, you know, for a nominal charge, then download exclusive content. So it's a concept I hope that works. I'm really kind of going to focus on the radio, get that up and running, but also the, you know, the videos and lectures. You can do documentaries. You can stream whatever you want on there for pay-per-view. And again, there's free videos as well. But the concept is that if you want to attend a symposium like this, but you may not be able to go, I would be able to get these lectures online, and for a nominal fee, they can download it instead of spending the plane ticket and the travel time and so on. So that's what I'm trying to do.
And you have any interesting news breaking on blackvault.com?
You know, nothing that sticks out. I've really focused on the media portion right in the last few months. Documents are still pouring in.
All of those things are well worth going over and looking at.
Yeah.
The website, don't misunderstand me.
It's.
But I thought you might have some top secret thing.
No, nothing that sticks out.
He's saving it for himself, folks.
Yeah. Yeah, you just got to log on and see what's coming.
Thanks very much, John.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. My pleasure. Good to see you again.
We need to give that URL for the radio project.
Sure. If you just go to www.theblackvault.com, you'll see a radio tab at the top. Just click on radio, and you'll get right into it.
And you didn't have any Secret Service men visiting you last night after your speech, huh?
No. I was pretty lucky. Yeah, I hope I make it home back to L.A.
It hasn't happened to you. It hasn't me.
No. And I will say this quickly because I know we got to go, but it being the 9/11 anniversary, after 9/11, a lot of documents were reclassified. And I've researched, again, biological weapons, chemical weapons, even away from UFOs, a lot of other different topics. And what happened was all these documents pre-9/11 were considered declassified, not necessarily a threat to national security. They rethought that whole process.
They used an excuse for all of that.
Yeah, and I was expecting someone at the door.
These people running these agencies have never had a secret they didn't want to keep.
That's right. Yeah, and you know what? After that, I truly thought I would get a knock on the door about the documents that I had. I mean, let's face it, you got 400,000, 500,000 pages of documents. 9/11 happens, and they're starting to reclassify a lot of material. I was kind of worried that, you know, it'd be a knock saying, hey, look, we've got to take these documents. You got to pull them offline. They're classified. They've never bothered me. And I'm not sure if that makes me even more worried or made me breathe a sigh of relief. I'm not real sure.
Kind of like the Las Vegas Review-Journal has been suing every website in the country over using things. Well, I, you know, they're saying you couldn't attribute things and you had to pay them,
yeah,
basically. We do a lot of Las Vegas stuff, but they never bothered me.
Yeah.
And they bother a lot of other people.
Yeah.
I have some permissions from them on certain stories, so maybe they got me by. I don't know.
You know, that copyright stuff is just getting out of hand, I think. You know, why would you not allow somebody to redistribute with full credit? You know,
We want people to take our shows and link everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. I have got no problems with that whatsoever when somebody wants to, you know, redistribute some of the content.
The limited thinking of people that don't understand media in the 21st century.
That's right. And it's getting only uglier, I can tell you that, because
almost everything is.
Yeah. You know, years ago you were able to put on some, you know, artwork or picture or whatever into a documentary and not necessarily have to worry about it. As time progressed, now you have to have them sign a phone book just to use a photo for 3.5 seconds on the screen. So it's an ugly side of the business for sure.
Maybe it'll straighten up, but I don't think it will.
Yeah, we wish it would.
Yeah. John Greenwald, thanks very much.
Thank you. Good to see you again.
Daryl Sims is next, the A.N. Hunter. We're broadcasting from the 2010 Paranormal Symposium, the second annual one, and we're here at Angel Fire Resort in Angel Fire, New Mexico. Don't go away. If you are a UFO show buff, can't get enough UFO programming, we suggest you go to our UFOshowstogo.com website regularly. Bookmark us. We put all of our UFO programming there as a link. It's easy to find. Simply go to UFOshowstogo.com. It's available as a podcast, MP3, or Windows Media downloads. Either way, listen or download. We do our best to give you the latest in UFO news.
Stopped 11:29. He actually gave us an affidavit of his abduction with his wife. They were following a black triangle around in slow motion. And he got back, found his watch had been melted from the inside.
Oh, really?
And they had missing time. They couldn't figure out why how the record guy got there within 10 minutes, and they brought him 3 hours.
Did you get a picture of that watch?
It's it is a watch that a DA was wearing the night of his abduction with his wife, and on the inside of it, I may want to get that at an angle, it melted the entire inside. Looked like it's been microwaved on the inside.
Well, as you can take a look at a picture here on our website, and you just heard Daryl Sims, the A.N. Hunter, describe why we're showing this watch. That's an interesting story, Daryl. D.A. was abducted, huh?
The D.A., yes. Not only was the D.A. abducted, but it was his wife as well. They were following a black triangle around one night. They saw it come over, and they were like, what in the world is that? He said, let's get in the car and follow it. And she said, oh, no, don't do that. And he went out, and they ended up getting abducted about 11:30 at night, and they didn't know that two or three other families were also following this thing around because it was low and it was big and moving slow at the night, in the nighttime. And they ended up having about 3 hours missing time. His watch was microwaved, melted literally from the inside, and they finally wrote an affidavit attesting the fact that they had missing time and apparently a UFO encounter.
Wow. This is Daryl Sims, everybody, the A.N. Hunter, and a journalist in Texas gave you that title, I think. That's what your write-up said. I didn't realize that. I've been calling you the Alien Hunter for 10 years.
Well, you can call me anything you want as long as you call me for dinner.
Yeah.
Since you're buying, I'll go ahead and take that.
Anyway, you basically, and we've done shows about hunting ETs, and you were on the track of one, and you think you got one, I thought.
Well, we have several DNA cases. Since I just last spoke to you, Jerry, we've had something really remarkable happen. One is I got a DNA assistant professor from the university to agree to do the DNA work on some of this amazing stuff we have. And then that was all lined out for several months. We're all ready to go. And miraculously, he quit talking, never said another word. And we can't get him to respond, phone calls or anything. But since then, within a few weeks later, I've got an individual that contacted me. And we have a major hitter who used to be a forensic criminal expert for the state of Florida. He's now retired, and he has agreed to look at all our DNA evidence, including the one where one of our abductees assaulted his captor with a sword and cut a piece of him off, and we do have that, whatever it is, we have it.
Yeah, we talked about that in Roswell.
Mm-hmm. That we did. So we've got that and several other pieces, Dr. Carla Turner, some of her stuff before she passed away. She left it with me. It had already been looked at with forensics and pretty amazing stuff, but we're going to have him peer review all this stuff and leave it with him and find out exactly what his views are about it.
You've been doing this a long time, and you have a law enforcement background, and we've talked about all of that before. In fact, I guess you're still a licensed private investigator.
That's correct. I'm actually looking for this guy right here. He's U.S. Marshals are out looking for him as well. We're going to tag him for some federal crimes.
If you catch him, do you make a lot of money?
I sure will. Yes. I got my deal going both ways. I get paid half if I don't catch him and all of it if I do. So
I need your agent.
Pretty good deal, isn't it?
Yeah. At one time, you were telling me, I think we were in Laughlin, and you were shooting some TV work, and you were looking for an ET, and you thought you had one cornered at one time. Have you ever actually physically, and other than when you're abducted as a child,
yes,
you physically come face to face with one of these?
Jerry, the reason I enjoy interviews by you is because you have some of the best questions, really, and I'm serious. I don't think anybody's ever asked that question before. The answer to the question is yes. I took a group of people up to Colorado that was 1996, I believe it was, and these were all investigators, and we had one guy that gets abducted up there every year, was my senior investigator, so we're going to use him as bait. I mean, he's going to get it anyway. Why shouldn't we be present if it's going to happen? Mm-hmm. We went up there and stayed for a week, and we had a trained investigator who stayed awake all night long, an airline pilot, command captain on a major airline.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, he sits there all night long while we sleep or whatever, and if they show up, he's going to ring the dinner bell or whatever. Well, I knew that we would never see anything probably until the last night, if we saw anything at all. But long story short is on the last night, they showed up. And one of them came outside my tent, and we could see the light. The light from the lantern, about 50 feet away, where our bait was, shone on the side of my tent, and I could see a little being about less than 3 foot tall, that had a head over a third the size as him. Which I'd never seen one like that before. I mean, I was really floored. I thought, man, this must be some kind of new model.
Yeah.
I couldn't figure that out. And I had a big Cutco knife on the other side of the tent, and I'm going to run it through the tent, see if I can't turn the toaster off, so to speak, unplug it.
Yeah, and you actually want to get one.
Yeah, I want to catch it. Well, they make 100 more of them like him in probably a couple hours, but you know, so they don't care if I lose one or not. But what was amazing about it, and then I got thinking, you know, rather than doing all this bravado stuff, why don't you see if you can actually still do the mental thing that went on when I was an abductee, see if you can still.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'll just do that because he's probably going to try to get in here anyway, and that's, hey, it works. And I actually could communicate, and I was absolutely stunned because now I'm not an abductee. I'm not a victim. I'm not scared. I'm not hyped or whatever. I'm clear-headed in the event. And I was amazed that my thesis has been that these guys, the small, real small ones, uh-huh, not the others, of course, only have an IQ of about 80, and I am absolutely convinced that that's true. I mean, I didn't see anything inside his mind. Other than his instructions to do whatever he's instructed to do. But he scratched on the back of my tent.
He's real or robotic?
My sense was that this particular one was biological, that he in fact was.
Okay, so he's the back.
Yeah, in my opinion, he was, everything I could sense. And he came to the back of the tent, and he started scratching on the tent. And you often hear this in these abduction reports. What it is, and I use the word nuke because what that means to me is that they somehow make the side of the tent or the building or whatever, where they want to go through, they make it where they're able to go through it. Well, whoever's up there in the craft watching this show realizes I'm awake and I'm in the tent. I'm sitting there with all my gear ready to get this guy. He thinks he can walk through the tent. Well, he can't. That's why he's scratching. He's not scratching the tent. He's surprised he can't get through because he's supposed to be able to walk right in. And we had that happen with two other people that night as well. And anyway, we didn't get him, but we did get confirmation from three other people total in that event. And, of course, Dale woke up. Instantly, this happened at 3 o'clock in the morning. He woke up at 3 o'clock and shaking, just screaming. And everybody like, what? You know, and of course, everybody knew then that something was in the area because he sensed it. And out of a cold sleep, he knew it right off the bat.
And can you expound on what you really think is going on with these abductions? Or is there various things? Are different people or entities doing this? Or is it all one program or what?
Well, to answer that in one way, as far as the culprits, so to speak, or the bad guys, if I want to call them that, the ones I think doing some of the pretty nasty stuff, I think most of those are pretty much tied together. But in rare cases, in about half a dozen of our cases, we actually have abductees after their guys bring them back and do whatever, lay them down, get them ready to sleep, and say, you won't remember. And just about time they decide to open their eyes or wake up or they get their feeling back or whatever. And one lady opened her eyes, and there was another entity overhead looking up. He was looking down opposite of her. Of course, he's upside down to her. She opens her eyes, and there's his big eyes looking at her, I mean, about an inch and a half away from her face. And it's not the same guys. It's someone else. And it appears that in these half a dozen cases that someone else was watching the work of whoever it was that did. They wouldn't know what they're doing and inspecting the merchandise, I guess. But we've got about a half a dozen cases like that.
Do you think those are ET2s, or those are our guys?
I actually think that they were the alien entity, and the one lady was pretty profound. She said, "I said, do you sense anything about him?" She said, "He had a membrane over his black eye." That's what do you mean? She said, "This is going to sound stupid. It's just tell me what you saw." She said, "He had membrane over that black eye." I said, "What do you mean?" She says, "It was like he was just hatched." I said, like this, he's on a training expedition? She said, yeah. She said, they didn't have the membrane off of his eye cover yet.
And what do you make of that? Does that back up some of
the information? It does. It does, Jerry. Some of these entities are so new when they come out of the box, so to speak, I mean, metaphorically speaking, that they don't know anything.
Yeah, when you say they're so new, you still think they're biological.
I think they're manufactured,
they're cloned. Rather than manufactured.
They're not born.
Okay.
They don't have a navel. They don't have
They don't have any genitals,
so they can't procreate, and they don't have a navel, so they weren't born. So it suggests to me they were hatched, cloned, or manufactured, or maybe any composite of that.
So you think we're dealing with some bad guys?
Some.
And then there's another guy.
Whoever these other guys are watching these other guys, and they're wanting to know what they're up to. It's really funny.
Well, you got a good point. It is funny in a way, but they're taking it seriously or they wouldn't do it.
Oh, they are. But it was amazing that she had her senses about her enough that she could actually determine, because we knew that there were, in other cases of our abductions, on rare occasions we'll find an alien entity that the abductee is conscious enough to know that that guy's new. They'd never seen it before, and he's so new he has to paralyze him because he's scared of him. Because he doesn't realize this particular abductee won't do anything harmful, and everybody, the other entities, basically got that one trained so well they won't do anything. And these guys are new. It's like they're on a training mission to begin to learn how to do what it is they do.
You, after all these years, do you have an idea of where they're from or anything?
Well, one of my better answers to that, in my opinion, at this point, someone has asked me this the other day in one of our meetings here. And I said, well, my better answer for you is that I don't know that the ET hypothesis works well for me. I said,
you think it might be interdimensional.
It might be interdimensional. But the fact is, they might also be. I've got some NASA footage of a craft that's about 2,000 miles long sitting inside rings of Saturn.
Okay.
No, it will. Yeah. It's, well, a little outside Houston. Yeah. You know, Texas is a big place. Yeah. Saturn's right next door. So.
Okay.
So we think that, as an example, that might be the cosmic GM manufacturing plant for whatever it is they're making, wherever they're making these guys and so on. We have several other films, one of them a craft about 600 miles across, 50 miles thick. And we have witnesses who were on board that particular craft, if our story is true, and I think that it is. But my sense is that is the base. It's not a planet, in other words.
Yeah.
So whoever these guys are, they don't need a planet because they're not from one, and they wouldn't know what to do with it anyway. No more than they know what to do with this one. They're after us, not the planet. They don't care about our planet. They don't care. They're not doing anything.
Why do they want us?
Good question. It seems to me, based on, again, 40 years of investigations and some of the pretty amazing things we've done in our investigative stuff, that they seem to be interested in two things that they've actually asked for from some of our abductees. One of them is, where is the human soul? And the other one is, where is the human spirit? They actually wanted to know, and the weird thing is, they didn't know, and the big question was, they want to know where it was at, and I asked our abductees, and they thought they might know.
So, I've done interviews with people that have done research, and they talk about stealing your soul. That may be possible.
I suspect it's possible. My sense is that they're... Well, one of the theories that people say is that we're basically, you know, just about a couple of steps above pond scum, and that's all we really are. I don't believe that. I suspect that we were actually created wonderfully and pretty amazingly, and the way we handle ourselves down here is pretty sloppy in a lot of respects. But my point is that somebody's come a long way to get whatever it is we have. We're only using 0.002% of our brain. If we're not doing any more than that with it, maybe somebody else has decided they could do a little better with it. I don't know. I think the problem is they can't separate us from what they want without causing death, so they don't get what they want. I don't think they figured out how to do that yet, whatever that is.
So not only these abductions that occur might be actually genetic experiments, but there's something else going on.
There is. My opinion about when people get abducted, one or two things happen to them. You either become an abductee or a contactee. Contactee is a person who feels like the events are okay and they can go along with it. Abductees don't agree. I use a metaphor that kind of helps this explanation of maybe what they're after. The honeybees, in my opinion, are the contactees. They like it, and they don't mind that there's a little guy out there in a white suit stealing their honey. They don't even think it's odd that he's there. I do. The other people, the abductees, the ones who don't like this, are more like killer bees. What does that mean? If you come over to get our honey, you're going to wish you hadn't done it. You're going to pay the price, in other words. They're going to come after you. You're going to end up with a bunch of alien hunters is what you're going to do. So I think that the alien, in my opinion, is not interested in breeding things into to make more little honeybees. I think they're more interested in breeding things out so we can get rid of the killer bees.
Interesting concept. Okay, you've done dealt with implants forever.
Yes, sir.
What's going on? Is that a tracking device or is it a control device? In other words, what is it? Do you have a hunch by now?
Yes, sir, I do. It's not a tracking device. It's not a transponder. It's not any of these things. A lot of stuff written on the internet is simply not true. We just finished our last surgery, by the way, in Flint, Michigan, less than 2 months ago. Pulled an object an inch and a half long out from under the lady's patella, under her kneecap. And we've yet to get that one analyzed yet. But the bottom line with implants is they are not tracking devices. What they are, that we do know, is some of them, there are all kinds of things. Number one, some are metallic, some are ceramic. One of them is an ocular implant. We've only got one of those and only heard of one in our entire experience. Fell out of the lady's eye at work after her abduction the night before, and her boss saw it, and that's how I got it, because the boss said, I'll fire you if you don't take it to that UFO investigator, alien hunter. She says, well, it's just a seed, and she tried to destroy it and get rid of it, like abductees are instructed to do. And she said, if you don't take it to him, I'll fire you by tomorrow. And that's the only reason we got it. But some of these things are different things. One of the things that kind of bothers us is that some of these things seem to have a coating on them chemical or other type of coating with maybe neurotransmitters or something to alter neurotransmitters so that basically more control can be maintained over an individual.
So I've always kind of had a hunch people talk about it the other way, but I've always thought it's they press a button, they control you, you know.
It'd be nice, I guess, for them if it's that way, but the fact is implants seem to be doing other things too. They not only, as one neuropsychologist told me, she said, Mr. Sims, she said, you're finding altered levels of neurotransmitters inside these abductees. She said, this means literally whoever controls your serotonin and dopamine, those folks own you, whoever they're, alien, government, or anybody.
So
they run your show. You are in the program. You belong to them.
What's going on with Daryl Sims? We have to move on, as you know. We got a lot of things going on.
Oh, yeah.
So do you.
Yeah, that's good. What's going on with me? Well, like I said, our biggest thing right now for us, the most exciting things that are going on is we've got about 15 cases of DNA stuff that we're looking at. We've got three sexual assaults, two of them by MIBS, with the DNA evidence. Now, I'm not saying that that's proof they did it. We're saying it's going to be looked at, and whoever gave me the evidence had better be telling the truth. Because if I catch you lying to me, I'll put you on the Internet with your picture and the story that you told it wasn't true. It's okay if you're wrong. It's not okay if you lie. So when you give me evidence, just be sure to tell them the truth. Because anyway, we've got the DNA. And like I told this one lady, I said, we'd better not find your husband's DNA there. And she said, you won't. And I said, how do you know that? And she said, well, the thing that raped me, she said, was about 6.5 foot tall, dark suit. And she said, a very dark individual in the sense of its character. And she said, it left so much semen. She said, it was like a cow. And she said, and I've lived on a farm before. I know what I'm talking about. And I said, give me the sheets, give me the bedspread, and give me the pillowcase. And she turned them over without a problem. I said, you better be right. So that's just one of the several cases we have. Then we got about a half a dozen cases of fluorescence that we think that will show us some.
You've been doing the fluorescent thing for a while.
We're very excited about that. We now have this, like I said, this DNA expert, and I'm very happy about this.
Really?
We finally are going to get some answers on what this stuff is or isn't.
You put this all up on your website?
We've started to. I've got a new webmaster. We're doing some brand new stuff. We lost our webmaster out of Greece. And so she's turning some stuff over to our new guy, and as soon as that's done, we'll probably have about 8 times as much as we've ever had up on our site.
And they would then need to go to the web and check you out when it's ready.
They sure would. They'd have to go to alienhunter.org, and they'd probably find your picture in there and all kinds of stuff.
And if they come to jerrypepin.com, they'll find a few Daryl Sims articles, papers, interviews, photos, even... You showed me some pictures once. I promised I couldn't show it of what you thought were hybrid fetuses.
That's correct.
Any more on that?
This is amazing because this forensic expert I'm telling you about, I'm fixing to show those to him and get his opinion.
Okay.
All the other forensic experts that we had look at these all validated it.
This is the first time I've talked about it because
yes.
You told me not to.
Yeah, and you're a good man for that. But the other forensic experts we had look at it all validated and said that off the record, they said, oh, my God. It's not human. But when you put the camera on them and turn it on, what is it? I'm not really sure. But they won't tell you, but privately they'll tell you everything. This guy, he said, whatever I find, I will go on TV and tell everybody. He said, I don't care, I'm retired. So I love this guy. This is great.
Stay in contact. And when's the next Houston meeting that you...
Houston UFO Network is on our. It's going to be on our website on the Houston UFO Network as well website, HoustonUFONetwork.com, and we've got a doctor coming in. Is going to do another presentation for us on acoustics and how you can basically control somebody with acoustics, whether you're alien or not.
Well, that opens up a whole new. Research topic on whether or not we're using that sort of weapon already.
Oh, we are. There's no question we are. I mean, you know this as well, and there are different terms for it, and this stuff's been around for quite a while. It's awful, and it's real.
Daryl Sims, the Alien Hunter, always glad to have you. Thank you very much for being on the Jerry Pepin Show, and we meet in Angel Fire, and we meet in Roswell, and we meet several places.
We do, everywhere. And thank you, Jerry. You're a great man and a pioneer. In the area of radio and internet, really, you are.
Well, I'll take that humbly. Thanks, Daryl.
Well, okay.
Jane Swartley is our web producer. Roberta Scott is our on-location producer. Shanina Johnson is also a producer here helping us. Until next time, this is Jerry Pippin. Thanks for listening. Cheers.